Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts on this weekly journey through all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome to episode 189. It is Martin Luther King Day. Happy Martin Luther King Day. I hope you've all enjoyed a great day off and that you're doing some fermenting for next week. Before we get started with today's show, there's a lot of stuff happening in New York that we'd like to shout out and get to. So first up, we have Homebrew Alley 11 coming up on February 10th and 11th at Alewife. It is our annual homebrew competition hosted by the New York City Homebrewers Guild, where Mary and I met, and ultimately the reason for this show and our enthusiasm for crafting and beer. Speaking of crafting, Mary, you've been getting crazy with other crafts. You've been cheating on the fermentation world, and it's been awesome. But tell us about that, because you've been smiling a lot lately. I've enjoyed watching it.
That's true.
Let's step outside of fermentation. I'm just excited about it, because you're excited about it, sort of, if you want to talk about it.
I'm just going to say that... So I've been doing a lot of embroidery and knitting and weaving lately. That was one thing. If you guys have been listening to this program a lot, you might know that I hold a full-time day job outside of the beer and fermentation world. It's a regular day job. And while I've enjoyed doing a lot of beer and fermentation and a lot of things outside my day job, I didn't have enough balance in my life. So I have found more balance in my life by spending more time on other hobbies and passions that I really love and that feed my soul and keep me sane in this world. So I'm still kind of finding the balance between working my day job, which I actually enjoy my day job. I cannot complain there. But it does take hours away from, you know, fermenting and crafting and doing other things in our life. So I'm still kind of seeking balance between doing fermentation and crafts outside. But so I haven't actually been doing that much fermentation. But I was just telling somebody last night, we were at KCBC, Kings County Brewers Collective, a brewery here in Bushwick that just opened last year and is fantastic. Anyway, I was just telling somebody last night that I really need to start brewing and fermenting again. So
together.
Absolutely.
So what you're saying is fermentation isn't happiness, but it certainly helps.
Yeah.
It is, though. It is happiness. I disagree. I think it is happiness. Anyway.
Oh, no. I think it is. But I think keeping balance in your life is also very important. I'm also have set a goal. So I listen to a lot of books because I walk between 5 and 10 miles every day. And, you know, while I'm doing things like cooking or sewing or knitting, it's pretty easy to listen to audiobooks. I can't read and knit at the same time, for instance. Anyway, so I listen to a lot of fiction audiobooks, but one thing that I'm really putting a lot of emphasis on this year is learning more, and hence reading or listening to more nonfiction books. So I'm actually I'm finishing Hidden Figures, which is a movie. I haven't seen the movie yet, but the book is absolutely excellent, and I would highly recommend it. And I'm also reading Eight Flavors. Oh, man, I'd have to look up the authors for both of these. But Eight Flavors is really interesting as well, food-related. But anyway, that's one of my goals is to read and or listen to more nonfiction books.
Eight Flavors, book by Sarah Lewis.
Hey, Rachel, say that again. I can't hear you on your microphone. Testing. Rachel's mic is off. Oh, but fermentation, it also means agitation and excitement, or if you go to the dictionary. So, Mary, you are fermenting constantly with multitasking. Okay, we're flipping microphones around, but we're talking about...
All right, hang on. We're going back to our announcements.
Check, okay. Back to announcements. So, February 10th and 11th, go to homebrewrally.com to become a judge and steward if you want to help, if you're available, to help us out at AleLife to get this competition of 750 entries together. We'd love to have your participation. After that, next up, the first... Fermentation Festival of its kind in New York City, NYCFermentationFestival.com. It is going to happen on the first day of New York City Beer Week, which starts on February 25th, or 24th, 25th. This festival will be on the 25th. We're very excited about it. New York City Beer Week is a 10-day celebration of all things beer and the culture here in New York City. We're really happy and excited to meld it and talk about how fermentation binds us and cultures together in the daytime festival at the Brooklyn Expo Center. More information about that and tickets at NYCFermentationFestival.com. Later late April, going back to homebrew competitions, if you are a BJCP registered judge and you can help and lend us your palette for the National Homebrew Competition, we are hosting that at Kings County Brewers Collective on April 24th and 25th.
And regardless of where you are around the country, there is probably a National Homebrew Competition judging site not too far from you. So if you are a judge or you're interested in stewarding or learning more, I would... suggest that you go to the American Homebrewers Association website, check out where the nearest homebrew, the nearest AHA judging location is to you, and then either enter your beers and or volunteer your time.
Enter your beers and your volunteers. All right. We just did the mic shuffle again. It's all good. We're back in order. Testing. Rachel.
Hello.
All right.
Cutting in to say that if you want to look up Eight Flavors, it's by Sarah Lohman. That's Lohman. It's available on Amazon, and NPR has a couple of good reviews on it.
And I just started the first chapter, which is black pepper, but black pepper is actually often fermented.
Fermentation. That's what this show is about.
So wait, I want to go back, actually. So Chris just mentioned that this thriving New York City local beer scene. We've had a lot of breweries open up in the last 5 years,
yes,
particularly in the last couple of years. I would like to congratulate the folks at Folks Beer, which is our newest brewery tasting room to open in New York City. They are in the Gowanus Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill. Where is it technically?
Gowanus. Just they're a couple blocks away from other half
area. So I would say
Carroll Gardens on the map.
Carroll Gardens. It's that, you know. It's a little
area of Brooklyn.
That area. But basically, I would say that that means that if you are here visiting New York City, I just had somebody email me actually recently and ask for some recommendations on New York City breweries. But if you are in New York City and you want to visit some local breweries, that adds a fourth beer on an easy beer route between Three's Brewing, Strong Rope, Folks Beer, and Other Half. Those are actually walking. It's a nice day. It's walking distance. Otherwise, you could always hop a bus or a subway.
We're creating new clusters all the time, which is really great.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. No, I take it back. That's Gowanus.
See?
Tell it's us. Tricky. Some of these neighborhood divisions aren't as easy as they look. All right.
Let's go. I'm excited to get into the show.
Okay.
What's happening?
So let's roll back to, when was that? Last year.
It was August 29th. We're on our way to the... Boston Fermentation Festival, which if you want to go back, we had a whole episode dedicated to some of the people, great people that we met there. And we decided to listen to a fermentation podcast. We listened to a wonderful podcast called Gastropod, which I believe is from, is it Pavley?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
I just get it through my little podcast app.
So it's a great food podcast, and they had a wonderful episode on kombucha and the origins of kombucha and some science research that they're doing on it, and we came across Tufts Lab at Tufts University, where they've been participating basically in all of these amazing fermentation projects at the open lab, including gathering kombucha cultures and cultivating sauerkraut, which is kind of amazing. And they study miso and they study all sorts of amazing things.
And they were at the Boston Fermentation Festival.
And we found them at the Boston Fermentation Festival.
Yeah, so Rachel and I, I'm driving. Rachel's in the passenger seat. Chris is zonked out in the back seat because we got up at like 5 or something in the morning to drive up to Boston.
Yeah.
And Rachel and I are listening to these a bunch of podcasts on our way up there. Boston's, I don't know, 4-hour drive or something. And we get up there and Rachel's like, oh my God, Science Quarter, Tough Slab is here. Like, we just had listened to them, so it was super
exciting.
We
should book them on the show. And then they're like, oh, they're here.
Who's them? Who's them? I'm dying.
So we are super excited tonight to have Esther Miller and Liz Landis. So they're both doctoral students at Tufts University. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So I think we're going to... I'm going to introduce one of you, and I'm going to introduce you by reading the official biography on the Tufts Education Lab. So let's start with Liz. So Liz Landis. Liz joined the lab in September 2015 after doing her, I believe it's Master's of Science. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
Research on soil microbial communities at University of New Hampshire with Sarita Frey. Liz is interested in patterns and processes in microbial communities across large spatial scales and linking microbial traits to community assembly. So, Liz, I have to ask, what does that mean?
Right, that's pretty wonderfully vague. I haven't revisited that for a little while. So, I guess in regards to what you just read.
Or tell us what you're studying now. What does that mean now?
Yeah, so I'm studying kombucha. In the lab, we call it fermented tea. But all of us in the lab study, and you were kind of talking about this, we all study fermented foods as kind of a means at understanding microbes in general. So we use them as what we call like a model system. So I'm looking at kombucha, mostly trying to understand the biofilm or the SCOBY that's in kombucha.
Okay.
So I do a bunch of experiments where I make lots and lots of kombucha. Like I think the last one I did, I made 800 different SCOBYs at one time.
Oh, my God.
And so I'm just trying to kind of understand a little bit more about how microbes live in the environment. And does that make a little bit more sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So when you made 800 SCOBYs, did you make them all under one roof? Did you find a lot of commonalities?
About the variations.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and also...
So those were actually SCOBYs that I was making out of various yeast and bacteria, but we also have a library of different kombuchas. We think it's probably the largest kombucha library in the world. I'm going to go ahead and make that
statement.
That claim, yeah. So what we've done is, actually before I got there, the leader of our lab, Ben Wolf, had started this collection actually through Etsy, because it turns out that Etsy is like the best place to get SCOBYs.
I did not know this. I thought you weren't supposed to send that living things over Etsy.
He started collecting those different SCOBYs. For one, just to understand the variety of microbes that are in kombucha growing on people's counters. And then I've been doing these experiments to kind of pick apart how the yeast and bacteria are interacting in those SCOBYs.
Very cool. So I want to actually dive a little bit more into this. So I have a science background, and I think one thing that's interesting is, and I also started homebrewing, which is much more rigorous than, for instance, kombucha production. So one thing I think that's interesting in that people's approach to kombucha is not very what I would call scientific, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing for practically producing kombucha to drink in your home. I'm more interested in getting into kind of the technology and science behind kombucha. So when you're talking about creating these kombuchas using bacteria and yeast, let's talk a little bit about what a SCOBY is, what this biofilm is, and how it's created.
Right. So actually, surprisingly little is known about that. And there are a few, great papers out there that have been published by labs that are studying kombucha, but the jury's sort of still out on what exactly is happening in the SCOBY. We do know what species are present. So a SCOBY stands for symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast. And usually when people say that, they mean what they mean by symbiosis is they think that the bacteria and the yeast are sort of like helping each other out. So one is supporting the other. And we don't really know that for sure. We do know that there are some species of bacteria and yeast that are almost always present. So the bacteria is called Comagatobacter xylinus. And the yeast can be a couple of different species, but the relationship between those two, the yeast and the bacteria, isn't super well elucidated yet.
As far as, when you're saying that, you're talking about like their relationship as far as, are they helping each other? Are they just existing alongside or?
Exactly. We know that, okay. So we know like in any brewing process, the yeast are producing alcohol. And we do know that the the bacteria that are there are able to use that alcohol to produce the like the fleshy pancake that forms on the top of SCOBY.
Mm-hmm. That's a way to put it. Yeah. So
as those bacteria are doing that, they're actually making cellulose. So when you see a kombucha SCOBY, it's actually mostly cellulose. And then there's some bacteria and some yeast cells within it. But exactly what those yeast and bacteria are doing while they're living in such close contact is pretty kind of unknown. So that's kind of what I'm trying to understand a little bit better.
Very cool.
What have you found in your research about kombucha that we previously didn't really know, now that we knew very much?
Well, one thing that I found, which I think other people have noticed, is that the yeast sort of tend to form in kind of little colonies, and the bacteria form in little colonies, so they're not evenly dispersed throughout that SCOBY. They're sort of like forming these little islands of themselves, which is important when you think about other kinds. So the SCOBY really is a biofilm, which is like the city that bacteria and yeast make to live in. It's like their environment that they make. So it's just important to notice patterns like that when we're exploring how biofilms work in general.
When we see this sort of tentacly kind of things coming down from that biofilm, does that tend to be any specific, what's specifically happening there? Is that generally yeast, or are there specific bacteria that those compose themselves of before they join the city above?
Yeah, so when you can actually see that if you buy kombucha in the store, they'll have like those little floaters at the bottom that make it a little bit less appealing, I think, but when you make kombucha at home, you see them as those little yeast. I guess I gave it away. They're yeast.
Right.
yeah, so when I look at them under the microscope, they appear to be elongating yeast. So yeast have these, like, two different forms. They can look like what you might expect, where they're, like, individual cells, but they can also elongate into these kind of, like, root-like structures. And that's what those little hangy down things are inside the kombucha.
And they're almost always yeast.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some bacterial cells on them, but whenever I've looked at them under the microscope, they're yeast, yeah.
When do you decide that a SCOBY is not useful anymore, say, for our purposes? Does that ever happen? And are they always revivable?
Well, you know, I'm not
kind of
totally sure about that, but I did actually meet a woman at the Boston Fermentation Festival who gave me a dried-out SCOBY. It was, like, totally dried, and she said that you could use that to make a new kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever done that before, but I thought that was interesting.
Not dried ones, yeah. But I've taken one from somebody's house that was like, had been sitting in a SCOBY hotel, which is where you keep your spare SCOBYs for a long time.
SCOBY hotel.
And I don't know how long it had been there. And then I like put it in a plastic bag, like a shopping bag. And then I put it in the fridge and I cut it up into a bunch of pieces. And then I used those pieces at various times, like throughout a couple of months, and they all were totally fine. SCOBY
Great.
Seems to be really hardy. Is it because of the cellulose community that it makes for itself, that these bacteria are able to survive such strange conditions?
Yeah, actually, so you're just all you really need from that SCOBY is, you know, some bacterial cells, and they're embedded in the that cellulose, and some yeast cells.
Some yeast
so
cells.
So you don't really need much. And in fact, when I make kombucha in the lab, I just take the liquid and transfer the liquid. I don't use the...
And that works as well.
Yeah, that works too. You can start a kombucha from just the beverage.
Because you're I mean, there's a lot of bacteria and yeast that are in that liquid. So they're basically, when you're transferring, when you're creating a new habitat for them, I guess, for lack of a better word, they're able to create that. They're making, the bacteria is making cellulose, and then the yeast or bacteria are populating it. Okay.
Yep.
So we have to take a break, but we're going to be right back to talk more about the science behind kombucha, sauerkraut, and all kinds of things.
Stay tuned.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Foment About It. So we're here with Esther Miller and Liz Landis, both doctoral candidates at Tufts University. Mm-hmm. And we're currently talking about Liz's research on kombucha, or fermented tea, as they call it in the lab. So I have to ask, so I think one thing that's interesting, and I've read some studies about sourdough. I'm curious to see if you're looking at how the communities of bacteria and yeast, or if and how they change in different environments.
Yes.
Oh, yes, you are, or yes, they do.
Sorry. I thought there was more to the question.
Well, no, I guess the follow-up question was are you looking at that, and what have you found?
If they change in different environments. We have tried to manipulate the sugar content in tea, which would make a lot of sense, that would alter the microbial community.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had an undergraduate do a project on that this semester, and it was just a short sort of pilot study. But it does appear that changing the sugar content might be altering the community a little bit. So we have to do a few more studies to assess exactly how, but the balance of yeast and bacteria appears to be thrown off a little bit when you add different amounts of sugar, which makes sense.
Right.
We have done some other sort of side projects where we've looked into how different teas affect the bacteria and yeast, but I can't say that we have any results to share about that yet. So,
and what about Ben originally ordered a lot of SCOBYs off of Etsy. So if you're ordering a SCOBY, so we're here in New York City, you guys are in Boston. If you're ordering a SCOBY from someone in Wisconsin and you're bringing it into your home or your lab, have you guys looked at the change over time, like getting a SCOBY from somewhere else or a different environment and looking at it if it changes once it's in your lab or in a different environment?
Yeah, so actually something interesting. So I'm kind of the caretaker of our kombucha library. And I've been transferring them for over a year now. And I did notice, so we used to actually keep them in these, like, really shallow petri dishes. And what would happen is over time they would make less of a biofilm.
Hmm.
Which is super interesting because, you know, they form that biofilm, the bacteria do, so that they can be closer to the air-liquid interface because that gives them closer to oxygen. So it seems like if you take away the need to float, if they're in these really shallow dishes, that they stop producing such a thick biofilm. But I actually recently went back to those deeper kinds of dishes, and I'm not sure if they'll revert back to making thick biofilms again, but I thought that was sort of an interesting observation, though I haven't pursued it too much yet.
Right. That is interesting.
Yeah, and I was wondering, among your research, have you found what it is about tea that makes it an ideal environment for this kind of symbiotic culture?
Yeah, so, you know, bacteria and yeast, they can't grow on sugar alone, so there's a lot of nutrients in tea. You know, all of the basically essential nutrients that those microbes need other than sugar, like nitrogen and minerals. So I hate to keep saying I don't know, but I'm not exactly sure what they're getting from the tea, though they are getting a lot.
Are these minerals found on plants? Speaking of plants...
So yeah, let's bring in Esther at this point. So we're going to bring in Esther Miller. We'll take a break from kombucha for a little bit. So I'm going to read Esther's official Tufts University bio as well. So Esther joined the lab in January of 2015. Before she was at Tufts, she worked as a regulatory affairs specialist at Oxitec in the UK. Esther's research in the lab explores microbial dynamics in the phylosphere of vegetables with a focus on cabbage. So Esther, let's talk about what you are doing in the lab right now.
Yeah, so what I've actually started doing is developing notobiotic cabbages for sterile. So I've been sterilizing the cabbage seeds and planting them in their own tiny little vials, which you can see, I think, on our open lab. So I can start to set up some experiments that look at how the microbes that live on the surface of the leaf interact with one another. So we've just sort of been developing this new system to start to investigate some of these microbial dynamics.
So when you're talking about sterile cabbage, so obviously there's absolutely no bacteria or yeast growing on that cabbage, and you're introducing bacteria and yeast. Talk about how is that done in the lab?
Okay, so again, we had an undergrad at Health. And they isolated from the cabbage, they mashed up cabbages that were grown in the field, and then they plated it out by putting, like, solutions of cabbage juice onto petri dishes at a very low dilution so you could isolate single colonies and get all of the different bacteria. So we made another library, at this time, of bacteria that were found on the surface of cabbage. And then we store them. Like, bacteria are great because you can freeze them in glycerol and then you can wake them up at any time. So we have our library of bacteria. And then we can take chunks of that bacteria, grow them overnight into new solution, and then we literally just put them in a little amber pump bottle that you might find sort of herbal sprays or something, and we can spray it, and it gives a nice, like, even coverage, and you have, like, an inoculation of bacteria on the surface of the cabbage.
So where are these bacteria samples coming from? Are you getting them in the Boston or Massachusetts area?
Well, before we started the work, we did a pilot just to see if this sort of project would be feasible. And we worked in the Boston area. We took samples from an urban site, from a in a common garden. We took samples in Medford, which is sort of suburban, and then we went right out to a farm in Lincoln and got a rural sample. So we were looking for site differences to see whether the microbes that lived on the cabbages at these three sites were different, and we got some data that suggested they were. And from one or two of these sites, an undergrad plated out to get these bacteria. So we have a sort of mix of where they're from, but they're all grown from Napa cabbage, and I think most of them came from Medford.
I'm really curious about how you made the cabbages sterile. I see that it's like in a grown box, but I was always understood that it just naturally occurs on the plant. I guess I'm mistaken on that. But how do you create the ideal conditions to make a sterile plant?
Yeah, so they would naturally have microbes on them, and if you just planted the seeds, they would. There's some sort of papers that I've read that have suggested that bacteria can be on the seed coat and colonize the plant immediately. So we actually put the seeds in ethanol and vortex them, and then in bleach and vortex them, and then wash them really well with some sterile water so that they'll germinate. And that removes the seed coats and actually makes them germinate really quickly, so they'll germinate overnight. And they grow in nutrient agar.
Wow.
I've heard of chefs doing that sometimes to lettuce in low percentage parasitic acid for the lettuce to last longer. Has anybody else heard that? Yeah.
I never heard that. Oh. So does it make the Napa cabbage last longer though?
They last really well. They last. They grow very quickly, and you don't actually need to water them because of the way that they're stored in the box. They just get condensation, and then it goes back down again.
Okay.
And they'll live in the boxes for a couple of months.
Oh, nice. So you've been using these sterile cabbages to study the effects of the microbiomes, and also you've been testing out sauerkraut, correct?
Yeah, so... What I'm interested in are the group of bacteria that produce the sauerkraut, the lactic acid bacteria, because not much is known about its ecology. Like, it's a very important clade of bacteria. We don't really know if it's the same bacteria everywhere or why they would be there. So I'd like to understand more about the dynamics of that group of bacteria on the cabbage.
Interesting. So this is... very relevant, especially if we look at brewing. So in the brewing world, a lot of brewers are using lactobacillus to lactic acid bacteria in order to create sour beers. And, you know, whether they're doing it by buying different lactic acid bacteria or by basically kind of culturing in their brewing system, force culturing, using heat and or grain or, you know, all different kinds of culture. So I think there's a lot of symmetry between those. I would like to go back to where you looked at the different cultures in a rural, you said you in it like a community garden or a city garden, suburban garden and a rural. Yeah. What was the difference in the bacteria and yeast that were present?
Well, we looked for bacteria. We didn't run the samples for the yeast.
Okay, so bacteria. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we found that the structure of the community, so all of the different species that were there, were different between the three sites. And we found that one site didn't ferment as well. So although when you look at the bacteria that were present on the cabbage before you ferment, none of them had a lot of lactic acid bacteria at all. When you ferment them, you select for the lactic acid bacteria by making it anaerobic and taking out all of the oxygen. And then we found that the different sites had hugely different success rates in fermentation.
Very interesting. Did you guys come up, was there one site that was better?
Yeah, actually it was the urban garden fermented the best.
Wow.
That makes me feel good about living in an urban environment.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. And this is just sort of some preliminary data, and I really hope to do a lot more work on this and just see are different sites better at fermenting than others. And it was really interesting at the Boston Fermentation Festival because we were chatting with Micro Mama,
who was saying that when she grows the same nut for cabbages, she gets the seed store, gets the cabbages from different farmers that have grown them with the same practices at different sites, and she'll find differences in her sauerkraut that she gets from these cabbages.
Right.
Well, that's really interesting.
So is that kind of one thing that you're hoping that your research can do is help? I mean, is help people that are producing sauerkraut or other fermented things
to find a level of consistency?
Yeah.
I think that would be an interesting outcome. I mean, ultimately, I want to look at the microbial dynamics, and my research would focus more on, like, the dynamics. But to know if there are differences between sites, then would be something that could be really valuable for producers. Maybe they would mix the cabbages across sites and not just use cabbages in one site.
Right, or at least be aware, you know, bring awareness to, the ferment, you know, the people that ferment, so that they understand that there could be differences that not all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if your ferment isn't going well, it gives you something else to blame.
True. So I would like to ask, outside of the lab, do either of you ferment food or beverages for fun?
Yeah, we ferment together sometimes on Friday night.
Friday night ferment. I love it.
We're quite lucky in this lab. So when we do outreach activities, we often have to buy a lot of cabbages for the display stands. And at the end, we get to keep them and we ferment them.
Awesome.
Oh, very nice. Making sauerkraut. Yeah.
What else? Let's talk about kind of the dynamics of the lab. So there are other people, there are other researchers in your lab that are working with other organisms and projects. So what does your lab look like or feel like?
It smells quite a lot. I think the smell of the lab is what people notice when they walk in. We have someone that works on cheese volatiles. So whenever she's got her plate open on the lab, that's quite an experience.
Oh, my goodness. It looks like you guys sometimes work on kimchi, too, which can definitely have a certain smell to it, if it's being done right.
I've done a little bit looking at kimchi, but I actually really like the smell of the kimchi plates because the Lactobacillus bacteria, when they're growing on those plates, they smell like really good, sort of acidy, fresh, funky smell. Whereas the cheese microbes can smell like feet or...
Right. I think we're all partial to our own microbes.
That's true. So I love kimchi, but I don't like it when there's too much fish sauce in it. Fish sauce is not a favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Mary sneaks it into dishes because I believe in it as a supporting element, but when it's in balance, much like crafting.
True.
Yeah.
So in doing your research, do you guys have any tips for anybody who wants to make sauerkraut or kombucha at home? Like, what are some elements that you can advise the best way to make it?
Ooh. Well, I think kombucha is such a great starter ferment. It's so easy, and it's so easy to become engaged with it. You know, like, I talk to people who make kombucha, and they talk about their scobies like they're a pet, you know.
Yes.
So I think it's so cool that people are doing that on their kitchen counters because it's just so similar to what microbiologists do in labs, you know, serially transferring microbes through different nutrients. And I just think that it's a really great gateway for doing more complex fermentation. So I'd say my advice about kombucha is just to, you know, go for it. Started.
Yeah. Is there any place on a SCOBY that anybody should ever be, or they shouldn't be afraid? I mean, the SCOBY is...
If you have mold growing on your SCOBY, then you should probably throw it out. But other than that, I wouldn't be too scared of it.
Right. And same thing with making kimchi and sauerkraut. I like Esther just says, just do it is the best tip. Is there the place to be... The place to be scared of that is kind of the same, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think similar to kombucha, I think this is where we all prefer our own organisms, because I would say that sauerkraut is really easy. I would definitely start with sauerkraut, not kimchi. And definitely, I think one of the key things is to compact as you go, like to put a little bit of cabbage in, shredded cabbage, and really compact it as you go, because there are have been times when you think your ferment is good, but there's like an air bubble at the bottom of the mason jar. It can wreck it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's and let's talk about a little bit why that is.
Yeah.
Because the oxygen can promote other bacteria that are undesirable. Is that correct?
Yeah. So on the leaf, you have bacteria that can be pathogenic, but they are generally aerobes, so they need oxygen to survive. And when you have no oxygen left in the ferment and high levels of salt, and then the acid produced by the lactic acid bacteria, it restricts their growth. But if you have the oxygen there, you'll have like a little pocket where they can survive. And you'll know they're there because it will smell like rotten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it might produce some other kinds of, you know, fuzziness or other colors or thing. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So I have, we've kept kombucha for a long time, and I've sometimes neglected it for quite a while. And one of my tricks is that I always have dry beer yeast in our fridge. So sometimes when my kombucha has been neglected for a while, it's not moldy. It's just not been transferred.
It's not its prime.
It's gone pretty acidic. Any other?
So one thing that I do is I, you know, prepare a fresh batch of sweet tea, and then I transfer my SCOBY and I add a little beer yeast. So I would like to know your opinion on that.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't hurt. You know, likely you have a couple different species of yeast already in your kombucha. And actually I've been, you know, kind of looking at what different species are present. Interestingly, there's, this is kind of a side note, there's a lot of Brettanomyces in kombucha,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure as brewers you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I was just that there are lots of different yeast present. You're probably not starting from zero. You probably don't have to add that beer yeast, but it might give it, you know, some special taste or characteristic that makes your kombucha yours. But I think that probably, even if it's really, really old, you're probably still going to have some yeast in your kombucha.
Yeah. So. Do you taste any of the kombuchas that you make in the lab?
Well, there's a pretty strict line that we don't cross with eating samples that come from the lab.
Okay.
You know, you don't want to
slip.
Like, one that smells amazing. She's got one kombucha that smells so good.
Really? I'm impressed. Where's that one from?
I actually don't have them labeled by their origin to sort of like keep me unbiased, but I think you're talking. I know which one you're talking about. It does. Mm-hmm. It smells like stone fruit.
Nice.
And like
what?
Apricot.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys can smell them, just not taste them.
That's right. Yeah, we smell them. Yeah.
So I think with kombucha, you can't help but smell it sometimes.
Yeah. We have this incubator in the lab that keeps everything at sort of like a warm room temperature. And when you open it up, it's just like this just wave of like vinegar sort of smell that comes over you, because we have, you know, hundreds of kombuchas brewing in there right now. So,
oh my god!
But they're in. You said you just recently moved to a deeper petri dish.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Did. Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific tea that you guys use? Is it like a brand, or you don't want to endorse anybody, or?
Well, I think it's okay to endorse them. We use Tazo teas.
Tazo
green tea. Yeah.
Oh, green tea. Okay.
Yeah, that was a sort of arbitrary decision that we used, that we made early on. We've tried it, like I said, with different kinds of tea.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like people pretty commonly use green tea at home, so that's just sort of what we went with off the bat.
Okay. I've been using a lot of black tea because I heard that it made it go faster, but I also haven't really tested it with green tea.
I really love all of the knowledge that's out there. Like, I am not by any means an expert on the culinary side of making kombucha, like making a good kombucha.
That's always hard.
So, but I really love that you can go on like Facebook or all these different groups and find all this sort of like hive knowledge about how to make the best kombucha. Like, I saw somebody saying, "Oh, my SCOBY is, you know, moldy. I need a new SCOBY."
And I was about to go on, or I did, I went on there and I said, well, you know, you can use just the tea, just the fermented tea to start a new batch. And then all these people were saying, like, well, actually, it's a lot faster if you start it from a SCOBY. And it's just so neat how there's all this, like, microbiology knowledge that's out there now.
Yeah.
That's pretty true, yeah. Or at least we think we know, yeah.
Right.
Well, it's a tradition of trial and error that, you know, that, that people are doing. Nope.
Yeah, it's just, it's, like I said, so neat that people are doing this, like, the process of microbiology on their countertop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little more relaxed, but yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you guys are so awesome for joining us today. Thank you so very, very, very much for hitting us on the Men About It. Is there, if people have questions, are you guys open to people randomly emailing you once in a while? And if so, should they find you through the Tufts website?
Yeah, I think we have details.
We do.
Yeah, that's fine.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Thank you guys so much. It was super interesting. I always like learning more, a little bit about the science. And also, it's very interesting to hear your approach in a lab to growing these cultures.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.